With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best of motor racing.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. If you're listening live on the internet, this is the Motorsport Magazine podcast, or maybe you've downloaded it onto some little tiny box with earphones, an MP3 or whatever it's called. On today's show, we're going to look at what's going on currently in Grand Prix racing, and let's face it, there's plenty going on, and most of it has happened since we last spoke to you at the beginning of September. But we're not going to go on forever about the Grand Prix of Singapore in 2008. We're also going to look at Fernando Alonso's move to Ferrari, Robert Kubica's possible move to Renault, Barrichello's possible move to Williams, and Fisichella's decision to leave Force India and go to Ferrari. Plus, of course, we cannot do today's show without talking about the Goodwood revival, which for some of us is the event of the year. With me today are Nigel Roebuck, of course, our editor-in-chief, Damien Smith, the esteemed editor of this fine publication, and Ed Foster, who was not yet born when Jim Clark won his world championship, so he gives us a slightly different take on motor racing as it is today. Okay, Nigel, let's start with what the media calls Crashgate and what we call the 2008 Grand Prix of Singapore, where Renault employed an interesting strategy to get Alonso the win in that race. What briefly is your take on the outfall of that?
Well, the outfall, of course, has been very serious. It's apart from anything else, a motor racing scandal, which has broken surface. Some do, some don't. This one did, and obviously, for the outside world, it's been very shocking. I mean, we've had the Dean Richards thing recently, and I think people are sort of fairly inured these days to cheating in sport. But I think on this particular occasion, it's shaking people up. I'm probably very old-fashioned, and it seemed to me most people's anger was about the incredible danger involved in this. And obviously, in any situation with a Formula One car hitting a wall, there are possible consequences, but I think that part of it was somewhat overplayed. And I think, compared with Senna's simply taking aim at Prost in 1990 at Suzuka at 150 miles an hour and hoofing him off the road, for which he was not punished, I think that aspect was rather overplayed on this occasion. The only other thing I would say is that, unfortunately, when I was writing my last column for the magazine, it was one of those unfortunate deadlines with just the wrong time. And in fact, I amended the column to allow for the decision from Paris that Renault were not to be punished. But what was not so apparent at the time was we now know from Pat Simmons' statement, and I've known Pat Simmons a great many years, and he is a man I would, in normal circumstances, absolutely trust.
Yeah.
Is adamant that the idea was Piquet's. So I think there's a certain irony, if that is the case, I think there's a certain irony that, if he did think of it and he got away scot-free, that seems to me to be somewhat curious. The other thing, actually, the timing fascinates me because the whole situation arose out of Alonso's problem in Q2 that day. It was a faulty fuel hose, which brought him to a stop out on the circuit. And that was what caused the problem, obviously. suddenly Fernando had been quickest in two of the practice sessions, wasn't going to be well up on the grid. It was going to be well down, 15th, in fact. And they really didn't have a lot of time between that happening and weights for the race, fuel for the race, being the stewards being notified of that. There wasn't a lot of time involved. So that aspect of it interests me, actually. They obviously had remarkably little time to work with. And I wonder just when whomever had the idea first came up with it and how much it was discussed. Not for very long, by the look of it.
Sure. Damien, I mean, you had the job of editing the magazine containing a lot of, you know, a very fast-moving story and one that had plenty of surprises in it. What's your overall feeling about the damage it may or may not have done to the sport?
Well, Formula One's got a problem already from what's happened the last couple of years. There's been so many different controversies that the sport's been dragged through the mud, and this was just another occasion when that's happened again. And I don't believe in the all publicity is good publicity. I think this is bad news for the sport, because if you look at sports like cycling, and maybe to a lesser extent rugby, but in recent times rugby, the sports have taken a real battering because of the allegations of cheating, and now we've got Formula One in the same situation, particularly with someone like Pat Simmons. That's why I was really disappointed in him, was because such a good bloke and considered such a good bloke in the paddock and such a great engineer, you know, over the years achieved so much. For him to stoop to this level, whoever's idea it was, whether it was PK's or the team's, for him to say yes to it, I think, is a real shame. Briatore, I mean, we featured him on the cover of the magazine slightly controversially earlier in the year. We always felt that he was a good figure for Formula One because he came from a different angle. He wasn't in love with the sport, but he brought a common sense to the sport, which was sometimes lacking. But we always knew that he was no angel at the same time. So maybe not completely surprised that he'd agreed to something like this. Again, disappointed that he would, but I've written my editorial this month that I'm the one that I'm really think who's come out of this worst actually is PK Senior, because he was a great driver in his day.
Yep.
But even back then, Nigel always talks about the fact that he was not the easiest character in the world to get on with for
controversial character.
Controversial, yes.
Stirrer comes to mind.
He's clearly been behind the stoking up of the story, going to Charlie Whiting and asking his advice about what should be done, and the fact that it's come to light as a cold act of revenge. You know, but it's damaged PK Jr.'s career and Nelson Jr.'s.
Such as it was.
Yes, I mean, he'd done a pretty good job of himself, hadn't he? Let's face it, but. Nelson Jr. I think probably will get another drive at some point in Formula 1 because they've got family money, and as we know, money talks, so he'll probably end up at one of these new F1 teams. I wouldn't be surprised, but he'll be forever remembered for this. There's no getting around that at all.
Ed, has it put you off the whole business? Has it put you off wanting to follow it, watch it? What about your friends? I mean, what's the view, really?
No, I think it's they're all very interested in it because, you know, Formula One isn't always sort of headline news, and so it kind of it brings an awareness to the sport. But, you know, for people who say that, well, you know, we saw Max Mosley discussing, he said, you know, Formula One will go on as always, we'll get over this, and, you know, it hasn't damaged the sport at all. Well, ING, the main sponsors of Renault, pulled out a matter of days afterwards. So, you know, I think that's proved that pretty wrong. Formula One, I mean, every controversy that comes about, we're always asked, you know, oh, can we recover from this? And it always does, I mean, you know, in its own kind of way. Mainly because there's another controversy about 2 months later, so the previous one's forgotten. But, you know, it's not good for the sport, but I don't think it's done as much damage as it could have done, or perhaps as it should have done, you know, something this grave.
I think, you know, it's a soap opera to an extent, the sport, and that these things happen and we do move on. You know, the Lewis Hamilton lying affair in Australia has been quickly forgotten this year, particularly in light of
not
this.
Not by Ron Dennis, it hasn't, but
I'm sure, no. But by the general public at large, I'd say. But it's the damage it does over time, I think, that it just eats away at the fabric of the sport.
Yeah.
And our expectations of the people involved get lower and lower. And I think it's just not what it was now because of because of the problems we've had in the last few years, particularly.
Well, I think one thing I'd add is the people are always on about the lack of consistency in this sport, whether it's in the behaviour of the stewards in the course of something, you know, something happens in a race, or to my mind, on this occasion, with the FIA, the fact that McLaren 2 years ago were fined $100 million, which even now is a sum of money that makes you reel, and were removed from that year's World Championship. Not very long afterwards, Renault were found to be in possession of McLaren material, and were not punished. And obviously that's a sound policy, because on that occasion Renault put their hands up and said, yes, we did it, and they were let off. And they've done exactly the same thing this time. So I think, I mean, I'm once tempted to say this decision not to publish Renault is an extremely pragmatic decision, because A, they didn't want the team to pull out of Formula One.
Sure.
And also, it's not only that, Renault is an engine supplier, McLaren wasn't. So I think pragmatism certainly touches this decision more than somewhat.
We must move on, because so much has been talked about this, but just I would like to ask you, Nigel, why would Piquet Jr. want to invent this plan? I can see why the other people might want to, but I cannot see why it would have served Piquet at that particular moment.
Well, I think if you think the point of the season it was getting to the end of it, and Piquet had had a, let's call it, pretty disappointing first season in Formula One. And, you know, everyone in the Renault team, not least Flavio, was very disappointed. So I think he was on fairly thin ice at the time. I mean, there were certainly people in the team who did not want him to remain for a second season. And I think, Flavio certainly had his doubts. Of course, Flavio, this is this double-edged sword thing, of course, with Flavio being his manager as well. It's a sort of, that causes its own particular nuances. But I think he was on thin ice. And I think he was, from everything we know, negotiations for him remaining with the team were at a fairly tenuous point. And he may have regarded it as, whether he thought of it or whether they simply agreed to it, he may have thought of it as a way of sort of vindicating himself and a way of justifying his continuing with the team.
Okay. If you hear the editor coughing away in the background, it's because he's got a streaming cold. And he's about to go and navigate on a rally, so the next podcast should be interesting, if he's here.
Yeah.
Damien, we hear that Alonso will drive for Ferrari. I guess this is no big surprise. You can see why he'd want to, and you could see why they'd want him. But there's a school of thought that says that Alonso is a fairly destructive character within a team unless he gets his own way every day. How do you think it's going to work for him at Ferrari?
I think it'll work very well. I think he'll be... he'll be world champion at some point for Ferrari in the next 3 years, and I think he'll flourish there. I don't think there'll be any problems at all. This whole thing about Alonso being a political character, I think it's overplayed slightly. The McLaren situation in 2007 with Lewis was... I think there's a story to be told there one day that... From Alonso's side, he's never really come out and told us from his point of view what happened. He speaks to the Spanish media a lot, but he never really spoke to the British press. Doesn't have much of a relationship with the British press. So it was only really one side of the story we ever got. And I think he had good reason to feel, you know, it wasn't working for him. And I'm not saying that's McLaren's fault. I don't think they managed him particularly well, but I just think the timing, the circumstances were all wrong, and it was a marriage that didn't work. And it was good that he went back to Renault at the end of the season. I think it was better for everyone. But I think as a driver, he's the best on the grid as an overall package. And the fact, you know, the way he beat Schumacher fair and square in 2006 says a lot for him, I think, because you know, after 05, okay, he won the title in 05 when Ferrari were not competitive, but in 06 they were back. Schumacher was still very much on form, and you know, Alonso beat him, and that's always going to stand. And I think he's a great character. He's very difficult to get to know, I think, for most of us.
Yeah.
But he's good for Formula One, and he's a top driver.
For me, the prospect of Alonso in a Ferrari racing with Hamilton and McLaren is a very exciting prospect. Ed, are you looking forward to this, Alonso in a Ferrari?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, we saw how exciting it was when Alonso was in the same machinery as Hamilton, and, you know, two great drivers in the going head-to-head. And, you know, this season we haven't really had that much, because, you know, some cars have either been on song, others haven't been working so well, and it's kind of swung back and forwards a bit. So, you know, it'd be good to have two, you know, of the top drivers on the grid at it. I mean, you know, I know we're going to talk about this in a bit, but having Raikkonen in the same car as Hamilton, I think, is going to be pretty interesting as well. I doubt he's going to fluster Lewis as much as we'd hope he would, just because of how well-rooted Hamilton is at McLaren. But I think that, you know, Raikkonen, Hamilton, McLaren's, and Alonso and Massa in a Ferrari would be an extremely exciting championship, I think.
Actually, one thing I was going to ask Nigel, actually, was in a way, it's surprising it's taken this long for Alonso to join Ferrari, because if anyone was the natural heir to Schumacher, it's Fernando.
Yeah, that's
certainly not
case.
Kimi Raikkonen.
That's the case. In point of fact, I mean, I've heard suggestions which have come to light in the last few days that Fernando had an opportunity to go to Ferrari very early in his career. I mean, in point of fact, before he went to Renault, and he turned it down and decided at the last minute, no, Renault would be a better choice. Probably not least because Flavio was his manager from the start, and he probably thought he would be able to progress at his own speed better with Renault, with Flavio running. And if you remember, he had a complete year as Renault's test driver after his time with Minardi. He had a year when he didn't compete in the championship at all. So the suggestion is that Tott, having been turned down, then declared that Fernando Alonso would never drive for Ferrari as long as he was there.
Ah, right, okay.
So I think that may have had a part to play in that. And I think it's significant. You know, Fernando did this deal with Ferrari in the middle of 2008, not very long after Tott severed all his ties with Ferrari. And it's been bubbling away ever since. It was simply a matter of whether it was activated for 2010 or whether they were prepared to wait to the end of Kimi's contract. And in the end, they've concluded they weren't prepared to wait. Yeah. And in light of what it must have cost them, I mean, the chemistry, if he carries on next year, if he does, I mean, he can't make up his mind at the moment whether he's bored with it or not. But the likelihood is he will go to McLaren, in which case, you'd have to say financially, he's looking in remarkable shape, because Ferrari are paying him off for next year, and he's going to have whatever accommodation he can reach with Martin Whitmarsh. So, you know.
Is he definitely going to McLaren? Is that sort of...
The belief is that he is, yes.
Perhaps he's going to buy the McLaren team.
Well, perhaps he is. Yeah, maybe so. But I think it would have been completely out of the question for Kimi ever to think of going back to McLaren if Ron Dennis was still there. I mean, they simply did not, God knows, get along. So I think the fact that Ron isn't involved anymore, you know, does open up that possibility. I'm very fond of Martin Whitmarsh, but inevitably, you know, some of us will be reviving some of the remarks he made just after Kimi had left the last time. So there are problems with Kimi. If you're going to have Kimi, you know, you're not going to have an entirely smooth ride. And I think that Ferrari, looking back on its 3 years, will be overall hugely disappointed.
Yeah.
I mean, he was sensational in the second half of 2007 when he won the championship at the last gasp. Other than that, he's never, ever looked to me like the Raikkonen at his peak in the McLaren years. So whether that's gone or not, we don't know.
While we're on musical chairs, let's talk about Barrichello going to Williams. I mean, this man is Dorian Gray of Grand Prix racing, isn't he? I mean, he seems to get younger and feistier as every year goes by. And I mean, he's fighting for the world championship, supposedly. Damien, do you think time he retired or no?
I don't think the fact that he's won two races, you can say it's time to retire. So it's, you know, why not race on? I know, you know, Nigel has always had a high opinion of Rubens, and I understand why. Personally, I'm less of a Rubens fan. He's a very nice bloke. He's kind of a bit of a throwback in many ways as a character, and that's good. But he doesn't particularly excite me, and he's spent an awful long time being number two at Ferrari and accepting it, really, you know. So I've always had mixed feelings about him. I know you wouldn't agree, Nigel.
No, I some of that I would agree with. I think he was. I mean, Rubens' argument was always, all those years at Ferrari, was that, well, you know, in those years, if you think back to, those were the years when Ferrari were winning everything. And I think Rubens' belief at the time was that the second Ferrari was better than the first, pretty well anything else. Mm. So, and I think the other thing you have to remember, when he was allowed to, I mean, there were occasions, quite a few, when he plain beat Michael Schumacher in equal cars. Mm. Now, if you compare that with when Eddie Irvine was there, for instance, you know, I always thought, you know, there weren't many people who beat Michael. In the same car. But I mean, I also think that it's pretty remarkable in his 17th season he's winning Grand Prix, which has never ever been done before. However, when you're saying about, well, it's a good time to retire, I don't think it's time for him to retire, in the sense that, I mean, look at him at Monza. I mean, he was sensational. But it might still be a good time to retire, because after this year, the likelihood is he'll probably never drive a winning car again. And so he's almost certainly not going to win the world championship, but he has had, by any account, a great season. And I think it might be a good time to end his career, you know, nicely, if you like.
Yeah.
Having said that, I you know, I think he just loves it too much to leave it.
I think that's the big thing, isn't
it? Yeah,
yeah. Ed, Fisichella went to Ferrari when after he'd had his best race ever in a Force India. What was your reaction to all that?
Well, I mean, for an Italian, I spent a bit of time out there, and for an Italian driver to be offered a drive for Ferrari, especially in his situation, he's got, you know, he might have got a race win with Force India. I doubt it. You know, to drive last few races of your career in Ferrari, which is the national team, is huge. I mean, you know, you wouldn't turn that down. And he's at that stage in his career that it doesn't really matter. I don't think that he's not going to get a win for Force India. But it was amazing. You know, in Italy, they don't really care who's in the car as long as it's a Ferrari that wins. And it's, you know, that's very much the sort of view that I got when I was working out there. And it's and so to have that opinion, and then to be offered, you know, as a driver to step into that, I mean, you know, you wouldn't say no, I don't think.
No, and I think, you know, it was quite funny. I mean, a member of the Force India team, whom I won't name, said to me after qualifying at Spa when Fisi was on pole, and I'd said sort of, Jesus, you know, what is going on? This guy just said, well, of course we're quick here. We haven't got any downforce. You know, we never have any downforce.
Sure.
And so they were super quick at Spa and at Monza. The car's a bullet in a straight line.
Yeah.
But again, you know, take it to Singapore and where were they? So I don't think Fisichella would have won a Grand Prix.
No.
I mean, had there not been a safety car at Spa, he would certainly have won at Spa, no question about it. But I think I entirely agree with Ed. If you're Italian, and at this point in your career, you are offered a chance even to sit in a Ferrari, you take it. And he won't race again after this year. but his future is now set because he's Ferrari's test driver, stroke reserve driver, and it'll pay pretty nicely. And you know, it's a very nice way to finish a career.
For me, briefly, I'm I totally understand why he did it, but you know, for me, it's a little sad watching him struggle with the car. I must say, not because I have any particular liking for Fisichella, but simply because it's either showing us just how difficult it is to get on top of Kurs, or, you know, he has not got the technical ability for whatever reason to get on top of it. And yeah, to see him coming around sort of 14th, 15th is sad, really.
I think, in fairness, just a quick thing, had he been allowed even a day's testing, I think it might have made a great difference. That's something we should never forget about this season with regard to a whole lot of things.
Yeah.
And also that Ferrari isn't an easy car to drive. Yeah. We know that much as well. I mean, just to step into it and expect to perform is a lot to ask. So, you know, I think he's had a good run at it, to be honest, as a Grand Prix driver. And it's a nice way for him to finish a respectable career, if not a spectacular right. career.
Yeah. He's doing better than Luca Badoer anyway. So
absolutely, you know.
He couldn't do much worse.
No, that's true. Actually, one thing that strikes me is, just can you imagine how Alonso might have gone in the Force India at Spa and Monza?
Yes, we can. Ed, I know you're a fan of Robert Kubica, and perhaps he'll move to Renault. I mean, this is all a lot of this is speculation, but hey, that's what we do sometimes. Why are you a fan of Kubica?
He doesn't fit the sort of racing driver mold. I mean, you know, a lot of people perceive that Formula One drivers are these sort of, you know, superstars, things like that. He doesn't come across like that. I think he's slightly more down to earth than some of them. Also, he's extremely quick. You know, when he's on it, you know, we saw it in 2007 and 2008 as well. He was just, you know, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And this year, he's had a, you know, really not very good year at all. But then again, the car hasn't been up to it. But I still don't think he's perhaps gone as well as he had driving wise back in the previous years. But I think him in a good car, or a car that would, you know, be near the front of the grid, would be very exciting. I don't know what everyone else thinks, but I think he's up there with the top sort of five drivers on the grid.
Absolutely, no question about that at all. And I remember a couple of years ago, a very senior member of the McLaren team had asked Lewis who he feared most, and he said Robert Kubica. So I think I've been disappointed with him this year, I have to say, because I still would have expected him to be significantly clear of Heidfeld. I know they've had a terrible car, but I thought he was actually the driver of the year in 2008. So I've been sort of slightly disappointed this year. But having said that, I think, you know, put him in a proper car and he's a match for anybody.
Well, as we are doing this podcast in the same week as the New Labour Party in Britain is holding its conference in Brighton, where I have to say the amount of hyperbole, hype and general jargon coming out is truly breathtaking, we must...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Remember that for the final part of this podcast that we must tell the truth and be frank in our opinions. And so, Nigel, I want to ask you, in closing on the Formula One about Briatore, because I know you've met him many times, and you and I both share the view that perhaps he, you know, people like him were rather good for modern Formula One. So what's your take on the fact that, you know, he is apparently never coming back?
Well, I wouldn't bet a great deal of money on that, for a start. Perhaps I'm in a minority, but I mean, how many years I've known Flav? When did he arrive? 20 years ago now. And I was always very struck by the fact, I remember having lunch once with Ken Tyrrell, and we, quite early days for Flav, and we started talking about him, and Ken said, well, I like him. I really like him. And he said, because there is no bullshit about Flavio at all. You know exactly what you've got. And he said, there are so many people in this in the paddock who pretend to be racers. And he said, you know very well, they're in it for the LSD, full stop. And he said, that's certainly true of Flavio, but he doesn't make any bones about it. And he said, and also, he has an awareness of Formula One as a product.
Yeah.
Because he hasn't been born with it, grown up with it. It's not in his bones. He simply looks upon it as something he is selling, and he thinks what he's selling is not very good. And I think through all those years of, you know, Schumacher winning every race and traction control and nobody ever passing anybody and all the rest of it, Flavio kept saying, our product is terrible. Why do people go, I don't know, I would not. You know, and it was very difficult to argue with him. I mean, he was right. You know, you go to the airport every fortnight, and before you get on the aeroplane, you know who's going to win when you get there. I mean, it's fairly soul destroying. And he said, you know, because he's flogging sweaters in the States for Benetton, he said, you know, if you sell the same dreary sweater every season, fairly soon people are going to stop buying it. And it always made common sense to me.
He's a pretty brusque and pretty direct character, isn't he? I mean,
very.
He's not everybody's cup of tea, is he?
No, very. But I mean, the one thing you could always say about Flav was, you know, he was absolutely and is absolutely not bland.
No. No. I think it's a fair cop. He had to go.
Yeah.
And we don't argue with that. But I think he will be missed. How can you not miss someone like him? You know, and as Nigel says, the fact that he didn't pretend meant a lot. You know, he didn't try to be something he wasn't. We all knew where you know his heart wasn't in motor racing, but he still brought a lot to the sport, I think. Mm. And I used to love interviewing him because you used to get this passage on your tape when you play it back. It was just this sort of noise of there.
Yeah, and well, I mean, because he just speaks Italian using English words, doesn't
yes,
he?
Yeah. It was really hard to understand at times. Yeah. Suddenly you'd get a word, oh, I know what that word is, and you'd suddenly get
well,
back
I think
the thread of what you're saying.
Very few people would say to the press the day after what happened, I feel wonderful, life is fantastic.
Mm. No, that's true. I think another point worth making about Flav is... I've often, you know, talked to Renault people, and as far as they were concerned, he was a wonderful employer. He was, you know, if you screwed up, you know, you weren't going to survive long. But if you did your job properly, he was extremely loyal, and they liked him. They liked working for him. And if you look at it, look back over the years, there wasn't much turnover.
No.
Renault. Not many people left.
And he worked hard as well. He wasn't just a playboy. He really grafted.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's to be commended, really.
I think maybe we should close our particular contribution on this subject just by saying, you know, it's been a very unfortunate incident all round, has it not, as for everybody concerned and for the sport. Moving on, we've got three more Grand Prix to come this year. And it looks very much as though Jenson Button will be the world champion, a British world champion 2 years running. Can't really see how he can lose it. So maybe just I could ask all of you whether you think he's the right man, in the sense that, yes, he won all those races at the start of the season, but since he's been, I don't know, could we say disappointing? Ed, what's your...
Well, actually, I'm going to rob some of Damien's words that he was saying this morning. That you know, he is a very, very good driver, but he's and in some conditions the best on the grid. But he was very much in the right place at the right time at the start of the season, and the Braun team was the place to be. So yes, he 100% delivered. You know, I mean, he, as we described him as driving a bit like, you know, Schumacher used to, and when Ross Brawn came over the radio and said, right, Jensen, we need quick laps now, you know, everyone's pitting, this kind of thing, he delivered them, and like clockwork. So, you know, from that front, absolutely brilliant. But, you know, the sort of dip in form he's had in the middle part of the season, I mean, I think every driver goes through it if you're in his position, but it's been particularly bad with him. And he's been, in my view, let off the hook a lot. I mean, you know, Vettel and Webber could be right up on the same kind of points as him if they had, you know, had a bit more luck or had a bit more success. Same as Barrichello. So I think he will be a worthy champion because of the way he delivered those wins. And let's hope he gets another one. But, you know, it hasn't been as hard fought for him as it has been in other seasons.
No, I think... I mean, look, I remember 12 months ago, you know, when Honda produced the last of their disastrous Grand Prix cars. And it was the end of a succession of disastrous cars.
Yeah.
But I think it was significant, there's no question, in that year, in 08, you know, Rubens did a significantly better job than Jensen. Yeah. And certainly, you know, I think, you know, it's fair to say members of the team reckoned that when they were up against it, and it was, motivation was extremely difficult to find, that they probably got more from Barrichello than they did from Button. Mm. I think as far as this year is concerned, yeah, I mean, the first half of the year, I mean, he literally looked unstoppable. The car was, you know, significantly better than anything else to start with. But he, you know, he drove it beautifully. He had a confidence. It was a sort of air of, yeah, which drivers sometimes get when, you know, so you show up expecting to win. But again, you know, when Braun did begin to come under a little bit of pressure, as other people got their diffusers sorted out and so on. You know, you would have to say in the last 6-7 races, again, Rubens has done a better job in adversity, in some adversity.
Yeah.
So I think, as Ed says, if, you know, assuming he wins the championship, and I can't honestly see how he can lose it,
no,
it'll be a fair result, but it'll be a shame in a sense that unless he does win another race, and I hope he does, when he clinches the championship, it's going to be quite hard to remember when he,
yes,
last got the took the checkered flag. Yeah. So from that point of view, you know, that'll be a shame.
Yeah, I remember in 07, Honda gave him a bad car, and I remember his dad telling me that, you know, from the first test, racing drivers know in the first half a lap if the car's working or not. And he got out of the car after that first test, and he was really down. And yet that season, he won a lot of credit for the effort he put in and the drives he put in that season. He lost some of that credit in 08 because Rubens did do a better job than him in another bad Honda. But I think the difference between Rubens and Jensen is very small. But the fact is that when the car is right and is competitive, I think Jensen gets more from it than Rubens does. And that's why I think he'll make a better world champion and is the right man to win the world championship. I think his performances at the start of the year, when everything is working within that small window of performance that he can work in, he's excellent. And it's been very... I watched him as a young man coming up through the ranks, so I kind of, maybe I'm slightly biased there, but it's kind of nice to see the potential that we always thought he had finally being proven. And no one likes to see a champion back into a championship the way that he is at the moment. And I hope that, you know, he'll put in a performance in the last three races that's really worthy of a world champion, just to you know, to so there's no doubts about the right man winning it. And I think actually in Suzuka, I think he'll do that. I think he'll put in a great performance there. I think the car will be good at Suzuka. It's a circuit that'll suit Jensen's very smooth style, and I think he'll put, you know, as long as he gets a good qualifying performance in, which is what he needs to do, and he hasn't done for a few races now, I think he'll, you know, he's got a chance of winning that race. And whatever happens to Rubens, you know, I hope he doesn't win the world championship in Suzuka. We'd like to see it go on a bit further, but you know, I think he's yeah, we just need that one performance from him, and it could come at Suzuka.
I think apart from anything else, I mean, if anybody is suggesting, you know, maybe Jensen wouldn't be a worthy world champion, I think really all one can say is, well, in 2009 then, who would have been? Because, you know, I've been staggered that nobody has made a concerted effort to take it away from him. Nobody has strung together a list of results, victories, whatever, to threaten him. And while I must confess, you know, up to including Turkey, Jensen looked to have everybody covered, you know, full stop. I mean, Turkey, you know, he ran away. But when Vettel won at Silverstone, and then when Webber won at the Nürburgring, I really thought then I saw the beginnings of a, you know, boy, the Red Bulls are really going to be up with him quicker than he imagines. And, you know, and it hasn't happened. Red Bull have had a very good year, better year by far than they've ever had before. But still, if you look at how easily they dominated at Silverstone, I was expecting a lot more of that in the second half of the season.
So it's been a funny season for that, hasn't it? I mean, I was trying to think historically seasons that compare to this. I mean, you think back 1982, you know, I think only one driver won two races. The world champion only won one race that year, in Keke Rosberg, and it was, you know, all the wins were shared out amongst a lot of people, and there wasn't really. I mean, Prost was the best driver, I think. After Villeneuve had died, but. Mm-hmm. It was a strange season where no one really put their mark on the season.
Yeah, it's true.
There's some similarities to that in this season, apart from the fact that Jensen obviously had that string at the start of the season. But from the second half of the season, you know, it's been anyone's, hasn't it? Really?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's fascinating to consider how different the season might have been had we still had, you know, testing as we had it in previous years. Because there was a sort of, all right, everybody got new diffusers once the controversy was settled early in the year. But there was a certain degree of what you started the year with is what you've been stuck with. All right, you can try things, but you're trying them in a practice session at a Grand Prix. You're not trying them at Silverstone or
except in the case of Mugello. McLaren.
Well, I was about to say, Rob, that's a good point.
Yeah.
McLaren, I think, is one of the stories of the season.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
To come from where they came from with no testing, I think it's remarkable.
Yeah,
you know, and Lewis's performance in Singapore, you know, he couldn't have dreamed of doing that at the start of the year.
No. I mean, I'm bound to say, if there are any of enthusiasts of Kers still out there, apart from M. Mosley, I really think the last few races should have killed that once and for all, because look at Raikkonen and Fisichella at Spa. You know, the quickest car did not win that day because of the two places when it would have been able to take a real run at Kimi, he was blown away by extra 80 horsepower. And I thought, you know, that's subtle, it wasn't. So I'm delighted that they apparently in Singapore did agree finally to do away with it. I think, you know, Spa could have been a sensational race if Kimi hadn't blown past Giancarlo up the hill on the restart after the safety car.
I have to say, it's I'm not a fan of Kers either, but watching someone like Lewis Hamilton make up places at the beginning of a Grand Prix with Kers is quite fun to watch. And it certainly makes the start a little bit more exciting if they've got, you know, some cars that are quicker than others. But, I mean, it's if someone's on the move with Kers, then it's very exciting. But if they're defending, then it's one of the dullest things you can watch.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the case at Spa. Yeah. So I'm glad that it's not coming back. But, you know, there were a few occasions this season you thought, wow, this is actually quite good watching.
I think the extraordinary thing about it is... somebody at Ferrari after the race at Spa. I said to them, "Well, you've won a race. A victory will last in in 09, and he said yes, and it's cost us 40 million. So when you think you're paying that sort of money to get an extra 80 horsepower for 6 seconds a lap, and you think they are nowhere near the power they all had every day 3 or 4 years ago, you sort of think, well, is there any common sense involved in this business?
As you rightly pointed out, Nigel, only Mr. M. Mosley is a fan of Kerr. So if you're a fan of Kerr's out there, don't bother writing us a postcard, because we've all decided it's actually...
One thing I would say for it is it proves once again how Formula One breeds technology, because at the start of Kerr's, the race people were learning from the road car people. And that switched around over the course of this season, because Formula One technology, as usual, has progressed at such a rate that it has moved on that energy recovery systems that will feed back into road cars. So it doesn't do much to the racing, I agree, but it does highlight once again that Formula One should be a place to experiment with new technology.
Yeah, I mean, I think surely one of the points here is if every car had Kerr's, that would be a different matter. But if some cars haven't and some cars have, it makes a mockery of certain races like Spa, does it not? Let's move away as far as we can from Kerr's and talk a bit about the Goodwood Revival, which took place in the period between when we last came on the air, as it were, and today.
No Kerr's there, were there, Rob? I don't think. No Kerr's systems. Goodwood.
I didn't see any Kerr's systems.
Didn't notice any.
No, I didn't notice any.
I don't think anybody crashed deliberately either, did they?
As Stirling Moss said over the course of the weekend, if we'd done that in our day, we'd be dead.
And he was right, of course.
He also said, Stirling Moss, I've never seen him so animated on a subject, I must say, as he was about the aforementioned Singapore events. He was very, very cross about it and thought it was, the worst thing by far he'd ever seen. But we were all at the revival, partly because Motorsport Magazine was one of the sponsors, and we had a big stand there, and we were quite heavily involved in what was going on. And Nigel, I used to see you at the Goodwood Revival when you were on... Autosport magazine, and quite a few of your colleagues who never come out of the woodwork other than, a Grand Prix. I mean, I saw Alan Henry at the revival, I saw Simon Aaron, I saw a lot of people who one normally wouldn't expect to see at a race meeting. What's the magic?
Well, what does one say? I think it was inevitable, apart from anything else, I must say this to start with. Given that we've had 2 years with Gordon Brown as Prime Minister, it was inevitable that nostalgia was going to be popular like never before.
Well, here, absolutely.
But I think...
And by the way, on that very point, Lord Mandelson was at the Goodwood Revival.
I know that.
The readers don't like politics.
No, I know that.
You?
And
courting controversy here.
And I gather Rowan Atkinson said to him, Prime Minister...
He did, and Mr.
Mandelson said, "Not yet."
Correct. Yeah.
So that's something else to keep us awake.
Well, the editor is telling us that our readers do not enjoy politics. So well, he's, sorry, he's, I rudely no, he, interrupted.
He's absolutely right.
I rudely interrupted
right.
you, Nigel.
He's absolutely right. I think it's. I mean, I have always gone to the two Goodwoods, and I always would. And I think a lot of it's to do with. Whether you grew up with motor racing, as I did, because I was very fortunate. My parents, particularly my father, was always a fan, and that was when I started going to races, when I was a real little kid with him. So that's there in my own history.
Yeah.
And I think but, some of my colleagues always go and some don't. I think to a degree, at this time of the year, there's an element of, with some of them, and I can understand it completely well, God, give me a weekend off, from the Grand Prix. But the people who go tend to be people who have a deep interest in the sports history. And if you have, there isn't anywhere else on earth like it. I mean, I when I was just out of school, I went to the Tourist Trophy when Phil Hill and Dan Gurney were driving the Cobra, the Daytona Cobra Coupes. And, you know, and I still remember that. And then years and years on, I don't know, what, 40 years on, to see Phil in the same car, at the, in the same place, you know, it's quite something. So I think there's an element of, you know, you go back there and you sort of, you can't help but think it was of a more innocent time, you know, in sport, certainly. And I don't know, it's you can call it pure escapism, and I suppose in a sense
it is.
But that's, I think, you know, I understand why people want that now. Anything that makes you forget Lehman Brothers, I mean, it's going to, even if it's only for a day or two.
Right. Ed, I mean, I'm constantly referring to you as the a younger person, which that is, this is a fact. Why do you love the event, bearing in mind that, you know, Nigel says it's all about sort of rekindling wonderful memories?
Yeah, I mean, it's, I have to say, you know, when I was much younger, my father as well was, you know, mad keen on motorsport in general. And but I, you know, living in Scotland, I didn't really get a chance to go to lots of the races. So it, for me, it wasn't so much as, you know, it's not so much going back in time and things, but it's it's just a spectacle, isn't it? The whole weekend is, you know, everywhere you turn, it's not just the cars on track. There's always something going on that's, you know, maybe it's the sort of the my slightly younger brain. It's, it has a, such a short attention span. It needs lots more going on. But no, but I think it's great like that. And also, you know, it has some of the most important cars in the world driving their doors off, you know, around this track. And you don't see that. You know, you go to America and it's that racing just isn't that hard. And in other places in the UK, you don't get such interesting cars or, you know, such interesting drivers. So from that point of view, it's the historic racing meeting for me, you know, in the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things, one of the reasons why Bobby Rahal so often comes to Goodwood is that that's the point, exactly the point that Ed's just made, that Bobby says, boy, you know, historic racing, but they race. Whereas people do say that similar events in America, they are more concerned about, oh God, I don't want to dent it, or we don't, you know, don't want to risk anything. And but the element of the fact that people really get after it at Goodwood is what appeals to Bobby.
Yeah, I mean, watching Barry Williams and Darren Turner in the mini race was just absolute delight. You know, I mean, just going to hell for leather. And you know, I spoke to Darren Turner before the race, and I said, you know, you're going to try and keep out of, you know, contact, things like that. And he did say that he'd spoken to the owner, who told him about the insurance policy and the excess. So, you know, he was racing very safely, but very, very hard. And that's what the crowd come to see.
And yeah, for me, as a child of the 70s, it's the closest I'll ever get to experiencing racing in the 50s and 60s, which I wish I could have done. You know, as Nigel and Ed both said, you know, my father too was a racing fan and would attend Goodwood as a schoolboy on his own, getting the bus down there on Easter Monday. And, you know, so Goodwood was something that I was always very aware of as a child, because you heard about it, you read about it, you saw the pictures, and then suddenly it was there in Technicolor, you know, and for real. And it's a great weekend. It's just it's a lot of fun. I think that's the most important thing as well, is that everyone there is there for a good reason. And you know, from the people who dress up and all the different activities around the circuit to actually what goes on the circuit, it's just great fun. I mean, I'm a little bit, I love the racing. I think the racing is fantastic, and it's always very exciting. I'm a little bit cynical about it sometimes, because not all those sports cars and are exactly as they were in period.
No, they're not.
But I guess, you know, that's the nature of racing, isn't it? You know, racing cars never stay the same. They're always developed.
Well, there was, I won't name say who it was, but there's someone, one of the drivers who won one of the races, afterwards said, you know, it's great this car's going so well at the moment. You know, it's taken a good 10 years of development. This is a 1952 car.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, in point of fact, I mean, there have been accidents in the past when some vehicle has been reduced to its component parts, and that's when it's become evident those component parts weren't the ones that he was born with.
Carbon fibre wasn't a big thing in 1965.
It hadn't really caught on in a big way in 65. No.
I think, I mean, it's a show, isn't it? I mean, it's a great show. It's a thrilling show. People love it. Yes, I mean, certainly some of the cars are not maybe as they were, shall we say. Absolutely not. Anyway, we're into the last 5 minutes now, and we've had a lot of people responding to this podcast, particularly when we were talking to Jody Schechter. And so I'm wondering, Ed, if we're going to have an exciting guest with us next time.
I think that's certainly the plan. We haven't quite decided to how many more we're going to do, but hopefully as many as possible. And I think we'll get a guest sort of maybe every other episode to sort of keep it a bit different. And we'll wait and see.
Somebody on my blog, Nigel, suggested that perhaps you could come along as Nicky Lauda.
Maybe.
there are many more as well. That's the thing.
There are many more. There's Jackie Stewart.
Surface here.
Maybe you could come as Jackie Stewart, Nigel, and then we could all sort of sit and listen to what you have to say.
Well, we could negotiate that, Rob.
Yes. No, Damien can negotiate that. Anyway, we, as everybody in the Formula One paddock knows, Nigel has an extraordinary ability for mimicry and is very funny with it. And who knows, maybe in future podcasts more of this will come to the surface. But for now, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back in
soon, to be announced on the website.
Yes, we'll be back very, very soon. Meanwhile, Damien is off to do his rally, co-driving Tony Jardine. And before we go, actually, Damien, we should really just tell everybody what's in the latest magazine to make sure they do go out and buy it.
Well, look out for the cover with the rather attractive Brabham BT52, which is the Nelson Piquet's championship-winning car from '83. And the issue does represent almost the best and worst of Nelson Piquet, really, because, you know, as we acknowledge in the feature, he was a great driver who was a great character, wily racecraft. Had a lot going for him on the circuit. Not everyone's cup of tea off it, as we've seen recently. There's lots of other good stuff in the issue. Lunch with Dan Gurney, which is a big one for Simon Taylor, one of his big ambitions to get Dan. Nigel's written a great piece with Mario Andretti, looking back at his roots in the dirt car scene. There's Ed driving a Aston DB2, which is very nice. Lucky man. Lots of good stuff. So we've also got a special promotion with something called Rory the Racing Car, which some of our old readers may not be so aware of. But if you've got kids or grandkids, then you will be. And my kids love him. And I think it's something that we should all enjoy.
From Dan Gurney to Rory the Racing Car. What more do you expect for £4.95, honestly? And I think it's a good thing that Rory is in Britain's oldest and finest motor racing magazine. Long may it continue. Anyway, look forward to seeing you next time, everybody, and thank you for listening.
Motorsport Magazine, for the very best of motor racing.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.